show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, a baseball prospectus affiliate. Now, it's here. Baseball season has started, and we actually have real, genuine baseball to talk about. But before we get there, introductions as usual. I, of course, am your host, Jeff Herr. With me, the indubitable Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing on this fantastic April afternoon? I cannot believe it's already April.
It's already April, and the weather's been perfect the last week, and actual baseball is being played. I don't know. I guess I am impatient because the Royals have two off days now. I guess tomorrow is one more off day. Yeah, this just quirk of the scheduling. But yeah, so we got to wait another day.
When Major League Baseball mandates that you start the season in prime time in front of everyone, you know, these are the things that happen. So
yeah,
a victim of success. Hashtag first world problems is what we're going to go with on that one.
Yeah, it still stinks.
It does.
Had to wait through all today and still all tomorrow. And then
we hear about everyone else playing baseball.
Yeah, like dude on the Rockies has four homers already. It's like the Royals don't have one yet.
There it is.
This guy's got four. Cano's got three. It's like what
in the world is going on, folks?
I want some of that home run action.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Hosmer, where are you at? Anyway, let's
we'll get to him.
Yes, we'll get to him. And before we get to the actual baseball, something I kind of want to cover. We're not going to spend a ton of time on this. We kind of alluded to it in the last show. There was some bullshit going around about the Royals talking about retaliating for Noah Syndergaard's graze the tower pitch against Alcides Escobar in game three of the World Series last year. And it was mostly nonsense and stupidness and silliness and New York media specifically trying to conjure up some sort of weird narrative and story and trying to push it onto the Royals. Almost like they're kind of saying, hey, there was this sort of semi bad boy Royals thing going on last year. Mets and Royals had somewhat contentious World Series playing each other again. Let's see if we can't stoke the flames a little bit on something that's not even there, on a tiny runaway ember that was about to fade out. But then the media tries to dredge it up. And then on top of that, we come to today, and we're recording this April 6th today when we're recording it. So this is when everything went down. And it started with was it Craig Calcaterra? Did he start it, or did he kind of jump on the bandwagon?
It was a reaction. I don't know who first like brought it up or
because I came into it kind of late, so I saw it mostly with Craig Calcaterra.
Yeah. So basically, what happened was, I guess, yesterday being Tuesday, when Noah Syndergaard was warming up, the Royals over the speakers throughout the whole stadium, they were playing "American Woman." Apparently. This was taken by somebody. I don't know if it was a media member or a fan or a fan tweeting to a media member or something. You know, I don't know where it really originated from. But the interpretation was that the Royals played it intentionally to try to get under Noah Syndergaard's skin, equating, I guess, his hair with femininity. And, you know, that breached into that they're calling him a girl. And then that calling him a girl as an insult is sexist, which it is. I agree with that part of it, that if you call somebody a girl or say they throw like a girl or whatever, that is derogatory, and I don't agree with that. I don't like that.
We're past that at this point.
That part.
2016.
Right, right. But that it just turned into this thing that, hey, the Royals
classless joke.
It did was. this classless joke of a sexist thing, and you know, I don't know. I don't think the Royals are clever enough to come up with something like that. Like, if it happened, it was probably some tech guy somewhere who thought it'd be funny. It's not like it came from on high. It's not like Dayton Moore
right,
was
like Dayton Moore.
Hey, you know what we should do. So, but yeah. Then it blew up. Then Calcaterra wrote about it, you know, somewhat, I think, stoked by comments from John Gibbons of the Blue Jays last night, who, in reference to the new slide rule that the Blue Jays were a victim of in a replay, said, well, I guess we'll come out and wear dresses tomorrow, which is also, you know, not cool. The implication being that, hey, we're not tough anymore, so we're going to be female. Also not cool. And so I think that just kind of like set it up. And so then when somebody started talking about, okay, well, the Royals did this, it blew up into this thing that, okay, all of a sudden now the Royals are sexist. And I don't know. I mean, I've been to dozens and dozens of games, and they play American Woman pretty much at every single one of them between innings. I don't know why you would see it as anything more than coincidence. And I don't know. I mean, Toby Cook said it wasn't intentional. I don't see any reason why Toby Cook would lie. Obviously, there's a bias there by Toby Cook. They wouldn't say, yes, we chose to do that. But, you know, I don't know. It's a lot of craziness. It's a lot of nonsense. And to me, it's much ado about nothing from the Royals' perspective. Now, if they did do something like that, and it was something that was, you know, agreed upon by whomever, then yeah, that's absolutely not acceptable. You know, anybody who would do something like that to you know, imply, hey, you're less than a man, and that means you're bad and inferior and everything, that's not cool. That's not good. But I don't think that that's exactly what's going on here. And it became this silly circular conversation of, well, why would I ask them? They're not going to say it was intentional, so I'm just going to assume the intent. It was nonsense. It was a lot of nonsense, and a lot of it, I think, cooked up from New York, of all places. And so when New York says something, other outlets respond and pair it and, you know, carry it forward. And it blew up into a bigger thing than it probably needed to be.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few things that I take away from this where I say, okay, there's a few leaps that you have to take. And you have to say, okay, number one, that people are still out there making these types of jokes, which I guess John Gibbons proves that they are. So that's, I guess that's the easiest leap to make, is that there is this joke out there of women being inferior, so forth. But then this, all these connections that you have to make, like, your assumption here by the Craig Calcaterras of the world is that the Royals are clever enough to make this joke. So they're assuming that they're going to play this song and people are going to say, okay, first of all, people are listening to the song clearly enough to say, okay, this is American Woman. And, oh, it just so happens to be that Noah Syndergaard is out on the mound. And he has long hair, and women have long hair, and this song is called American Woman, and it's directed at Noah Syndergaard, and we're trying to get inside his head, and it's funny because we're trying to say that he can't play baseball as well because he is a woman, because his long hair. Like, I mean, it's just, it's such silliness and ridiculous. And like you said, if it was one thing where the Royals have never played American Woman before on at the game on the loudspeaker or whatever, and then they played it this one time, mm-hmm. then you might have a case. And if that is and if there was on some level some intent by the Royals to say, hey, Noah Syndergaard is a woman, you know, we're sixth graders and this is funny. If that was the true intent, then that's a really bad look, and that is, you know, inappropriate, and the Royals should be called out for it. But knowing the organization, knowing how the stadium operates, and having been to a game when pitchers without long hair, who the Royals don't have a past history with, are out there while American Woman is playing, I can say that I don't think there was any intent by the Royals. So, and it's weird too, because you have, you know, there was Craig Calcaterra got into some Twitter spats with some of the some Royals Twitter Royals fans on Twitter, and his justification was, you know, the Royals either did it intentionally, and it was the Royals either did it intentionally, or they're so tone deaf that they should be called out for it anyway. And it's like, you can't give them at this point, they were giving just enough credit to the Royals to write an inflammatory article saying, oh, well, they're smart enough to try and make this joke to think that people are going to make, you know, a logical leap that takes multiple steps to realize it's American Woman, realize Noah Syndergaard has long hair, and try and piece it all together to be an insult. They're saying the Royals are clever enough to try and do that, but then they're also saying that the Royals are stupid enough to actually do it. You know, like if you're at the point where you're going to think along those lines to where you're not going to think and use that those steps of logic and then get to the point where, oh, this is going to go over well if we do this, you know, it's just, it's all a bunch of nonsense and stupid. Yeah. And I wanted to talk about it. And cause like, and it is an important issue, you know, like there were what John Gibbons said, you know, that is absolutely bad. And there is that kind of undercurrent of sexism that kind of permeates all of sports, that there's this mandate of manliness that you have to have, and that women can't have this same level of toughness strictly because they're women. And that's just a dumb, antiquated thing, philosophy to have. I mean, I saw my wife give birth, and I promise you, that was tougher than anything I've ever experienced or will ever experience. So there's none of that going on. And it's just, the whole thing was dumb, but I wanted to talk about it. Cause I did, you know, I'm obviously biased. We never made any bones about the fact that I'm definitely biased towards the Royals. And it's certainly something that, like we mentioned, it's a bad look if it's true. But I honestly don't believe it to be true. And I think on the part of the reporters that tried to perpetuate this, who didn't call the Royals, didn't get a statement from them, only went off of things that other people had said and heard, it was lazy. And I thought that was kind of the part that got to me the most.
Yeah. It comes down to, like, if the Royals actually did this, if somebody actually decided, hey, let's do this, like, where's the benefit to that, you know? Best case, you get into Syndergaard and maybe you hit him around a little bit, but you still, you know, if somebody makes that connection, you're still looking bad. So there's not much of a benefit. And then if you do get, you know, nailed on it and still get your, you know, your tails whipped, well, you know, then there's no win. And it just doesn't seem like there's an incentive to try to do it. Plus, I was at that game and I didn't even hear it. I didn't know until, you know, I heard about all this that, hey, it was playing. I guess, you know, I have no reason to doubt that it was playing. I mean, I'm sure it was playing. I didn't hear it. You know, it was right after the ring ceremony. It was right after all of the introductions and everything. You know, at that point in the game, people are trying to get into their seats. They're coming back from the concessions. I just don't. It was a non-story that turned into a nonsense story, I guess. So I don't get it. I kind of get the point that, hey, I'm a Royals fan, so obviously I'm going to be more inclined to defend them and say, you know, brush it off, at least as far as like their involvement in any way. But I also don't think that this would move the radar if it was any other team. I just don't see that it's a thing that I can apply fault or intent to a team just because it happened. You know, just because it happened doesn't mean anything. It's just, okay, they played the song, that's it. And you know, I don't think that my being a Royals fan takes me too far out of being able to say, well, I just don't think that that was anything intentional, and you know, we should move on. Not on the bigger issue, you know. You know, I certainly don't want to be dismissive of the issue of the sexism inherent in baseball. I mean, you just watch Twitter when Jessica Mendoza's talking on Sunday Night Baseball. She's a fantastic analyst. Absolutely. But, you know, there are just some people out there that just cannot accept that a woman might have some knowledge or interest in baseball just on its own sake, just because she's, you know, intellectually curious about it. It's just it's so absolutely foreign to him, and that's sad. I mean, it is 2016. We should be past that. So, you know, I guess to wrap it up, I don't think the Royals had any intent, any conspiracy to try to do this. I don't think that it's anything that they meant to happen. I think the reaction was, I don't know, crazy, nonsensical, inflammatory. I don't know what the right word is for it. Just, I don't know. It was something that blew up that got kind of annoying, and still more of the same, you know, mischaracterization of Kansas City as a whole and just of the situation. So it was kind of annoying to follow it.
Yeah. And last thing I'll mention, talking about there was the childish argument of to the Royals fans arguing of, well, you Royals fans wouldn't even care about this if it was another team. And it's like, well, I mean, yeah, okay. You know what? Like if Craig Calcaterra wrote this about the flipping Blue Jays or something, you know, whatever. But I wouldn't tweet at him and say, you know, this is completely ridiculous and lazy because it's not my team. But if I read that article, I would think it no less idiotic. You know, it's following the arguments on Twitter were really funny because you saw classic case of, you ever seen the movie Thank You for Smoking, Mike?
I have seen parts of it.
So there's a scene where the dad is talking to his son and he's trying to tell his son how to argue. And he's like, if you can change the topic to what you want to talk about, you'll never lose an argument. And they're talking about ice cream and he's like, I've got chocolate ice cream. And his son's like, I like vanilla the best, blah, blah, blah. And the guy's like, well, you know, I want to live in a world where we're free to choose ice cream and we don't have to worry, you know, we don't have to choose chocolate or vanilla, blah, blah, blah. It's just kind of, it was kind of funny. And that's the kind of logic that was happening where it was, you know, oh, let's not talk about why I didn't reach out to the Royals or why, you know, this is a non-story or all this kind of stuff, but let's just keep kind of moving the goalposts, if you will, and stuff. I thought that was kind of stupid, but anyway, enough of the nonsense. Let's talk about some real sense, some actual baseball. So the Royals, they were 7-0 last year, got off to that super hot start, and that is already not going to happen this year. So the 162-0 is off the table, but 161-1 is still there because the Royals are 1-1. They won opening night, which was the big one. That was the one I really wanted. I was worried they'd actually lose both games because, damn, the Mets pitching is so good.
Yeah.
But I'm glad they got that first one. They got it off Matt Harvey, the Dark Knight himself, if you will. And there were, you know, not a ton of stuff. I mean, it's two games. There's not a ton to talk about. But there is one interesting thing, Mike, I wanted to discuss. Well, a couple interesting things. The first one that I want to talk about is the use of Joaquin Soria. Now, first of all, so fantastic to see Joaquin Soria back in Royals blue, the number 48, the whole deal. I heard did they play Welcome to the Jungle when he came out? I heard they did that. Did somebody make that up?
They did play the song. They didn't do the flames animation that they used to do when he was the closer. They, you know, basically finished out whatever ad or whatever video they were doing, and then as he started to warm up, then they played it, and which it doesn't have the same impact. I mean, what I remember is just stuff like, there was one game, this was I think maybe 2010, I was at a game with my sisters and it was against the Yankees and it was delayed by rain like three or four times, and finally about like 1 a.m. the Royals have a lead, they actually go to Soria, and we're sitting back at like section, I don't know, 120 or something, you know, we snuck down from the top because nobody else was there. There was like 1,000 people because it was 1 a.m. and it had been raining all day. And so I would like, just watch the scoreboard. Just watch. And it was like, they thought it was so cool that there's all this, you know, flame animations and stuff and the song and everything. It was just like, that's a cool thing. That's the thing. When Soria signed back with the Royals back in December, I think it was, that was the first reaction. It was like, I got to find that video. And they're not playing it yet. So, but they did play the song. So they got that part.
That super cool to see him back. Now, that said, in game one, the Royals jumped out to a 4-0 lead, took that into the eighth inning, and Edinson Volquez pitched a fantastic six innings for opening night. Then Kelvin Herrera came in for the seventh inning, pitched fantastic. And then Joaquin Soria comes in for the eighth inning and starts off really rocky. He walks two batters, gives up two hits. Next thing you know, it's three runs have scored. And what was a comfortable 4-0 lead is now a 4-3 game. Soria is able to get two outs, but was it bases loaded or was it runners at the corners when he took out? I cannot remember now that I think about it.
He came out with runners on first and second.
Oh, first and second. Okay.
Yep.
So he comes out, and then Luke Hochaver, fireman extraordinaire, comes in to save the day, which he does. And then, of course, Wade Davis comes in to close it out. However, it caused a little bit of an uproar on Twitter because the naysayers to the Soria signing started coming out. Oh, I told you. I told you so.
Right.
This is him. This is the Soria that we didn't want. This is why I didn't like the signing. I was right, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, because jumping to conclusions after one game, specifically the first game of the season, is something that we like to do. You know, that's what Twitter was made for.
It's really fun, actually.
Absolutely. So, you know, and you and I are both on record as, you know, liking the Soria signing more than we disliked it. Mm-hmm. And I still stand that way, and I still think he's going to have a really good season. You know, is he going to have a Wade Davis-like season? No. But he's still going to have a sub-3 ERA as a reliever, and that's very valuable, especially with the rest of this bullpen and the way they look. Now, so that said, it was a little discouraging to see him do that, but it's first game of the season. And if you look past just the stats, though, it was the thing that I questioned most about it was how he was used, meaning – it was really surprising to my thought, right, was you would have, you know, locked in Wade Davis the ninth, Kelvin Herrera the eighth, and then you could probably make an argument either way for Soria and Hochaver in the seventh. But I would personally go with Hochaver in the seventh and then have Soria as your sixth inning kind of swing guy to fill in for those three. But he bypasses Hochaver, puts Herrera out in the seventh, and then brings Soria in for the eighth, which was kind of perplexing to me because, like I said, that's not how I would have done it, but that's how Ned Yost wants to do it. And Jess Mendoza on the broadcast brought up a good point that when you have two guys that throw a ton of heat, like your Kelvin Herrera, Wade Davis, and then you've got, you know, I'm not going to call Soria a soft tosser, but certainly relative to those two, he is. So
it's not fair to compare his 92 to 97 and 100 with movement.
Right.
It's like, just, yeah.
So, you know, but there's some gamesmanship there to say, you know, oh, get used to this fireballer. And then all of a sudden it's this guy who's a little bit more of a finesse pitcher and then back to a fireballer again with Wade Davis. I mean, the fallacy in that is that you know those relievers are only seeing each hitter once, so mm-hmm. It's not like a hitter is getting used to some. But anyway, I mean, when you saw that the way he was used by Ned, and it seemingly, you know, based on his on Yost's comments, that's almost kind of the intention going forward to use him that way. I mean, what? Were you on board with that? Did you think that was a little awkward or a little weird as well, or how did you view that?
I didn't expect it for sure. I, you know, when it was always HDH and you know, Herrera, Davis, Holland, and that when Holland went down, it just seemed natural that the other two would move up. And Herrera is, you know, just as good. He could close on a large amount of teams in the big leagues. He could be that guy if he needed to. So I'm surprised that they wouldn't just move him up to the setup. I kind of get the Mendoza explanation of alternating the velocities. You'll do the same thing with, you know, starters often enough, where, you know, maybe you'll have Volquez who throws hard, then you have Chris Young, and next you're going to have Ventura. So if you get to another series, you get to have a hard-ish thrower in Volquez, a soft thrower in Young, and then Ventura maybe in three-game series against the same team, give them different looks. But like you said, if you're talking about relievers, they're only facing probably 3 to 5 batters per appearance. So you don't really get that unless they're trying to time things from the bench, you know, guys who might be on deck or maybe coming up down the lineup. But I really figured that Herrera, I mean, he's pitched well throughout his Kansas City career. He pitched okay in spring training. He, you know, has the slider that we've talked about multiple times. You know, I would assume that he would be that eighth inning guy, and you just lock it down. And, you know, Soria, when he was with the Pirates last year, most of the time he came in the seventh inning. So it's not even like he was a setup guy for the Pirates. Maybe they felt more inclined to use Soria in that spot because the Royals at that time had a 4-run lead. Maybe the plan was that they'd use Soria, then Hochaver, and maybe save Wade Davis for another day if they didn't need him. I don't know if that was anything that Yost brought up or anything, but I was a little bit surprised. You know, once they went with Herrera before Soria in the first place, that was pretty much where the decision was made. And maybe that's something that they're going to continue. You know, I don't know. I think Soria will pitch fine. I think he'll be okay. Nothing was hit particularly hard in that inning against the Mets. He gave up a couple of bloops on jam shots that they hit the other way. Ligaris hit a curveball that he just kind of got the bat on it from at least where I was standing. So it didn't seem like, it wasn't like guys were, you know, crushing it to the gap or anything. He walked a couple guys. The control wasn't great, but
he wasn't Ryan Madsen against the Blue Jays.
Right. Where he just loses it. It strangely enough, it was always against the Blue Jays with Madsen. It was weird, but he came out the very next day and looked fine. You know, he yesterday when he was pitching, he what 1-2-3 inning, I believe. So
yeah, with 2 strikeouts, I think.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, he looked. I was going to mention that he kind of redeemed himself. And Ed Yost even said afterwards, after the second outing, you know, that was the goal. Wanted when there was an opportunity for Soria to come in, wanted him to come in, get that kind of bad outing off his chest, and that's what he did.
Yeah, and it's a short memory kind of thing. That's what you have to have as a reliever, and it's Soria who has closed for multiple teams for
he's what, the third seasons? All-time on the Royals list?
That would sound about right.
130-some closes, or closes. God, I'm off tonight. Saves.
closes.
Do I even baseball? I don't even think I baseball.
Yeah, I mean, he's got to be in that territory. I don't know off the top of my head, but I mean, who else is around there? Quisenberry, Holland, Soria. I mean, Montgomery. If he's not top three, he's top four. So,
yeah, I don't know. Holland has more. That's a good question. Let's do this. Let's check this out. We're going to look that up really quick and see. But to kind of finish up on this topic, it was a little curious. The two things to take away is that my curiosity at the fact, but also that I don't think the one performance was indicative of Soria's performance moving forward. I think he's going to have a really good season, and I am happy that they acquired him. So, you know, try and amicably move forward with Soria in the pen, and everyone can just calm down a little bit after that second outing, hopefully.
Right. And I don't know. I think it's always kind of weird because we always kind of get into this, and I think I bring this up every year where we come back into a new baseball season. And in this case, it's the Royals, where we've just had 2 playoff years where every pitch, every game is tense. Everything means something. You know, one game can swing a series and things like that. You come back after, you know, in the winter, you've got football where, you know, one game can change it all. One, you know, win or go home. You know, March Madness, you know, the tournament just ended. One play can swing it. It's just like so much leading back into baseball is built on this feeling of urgency and just suddenness and the importance of one moment, one game. And God, baseball is so much more measured than that. It's so much slower than that. I mean, if you look at just in a general, I mean, the Royals are 1-1. You know, okay, do you panic because they lost yesterday? I sure don't. I mean, they got beat by a really good pitcher and a really good team, and they didn't play poorly in the first place. If the Royals, you know, go 7-6 on every 2-week stretch, they're going to win 87 games. You know, so you just need to be a little tiny bit better than 7-6 in every 2-week stretch. And that's all it takes. It's that how baseball is all about how those small differences and improvements accumulate and build over time. And the Royals have a team that, you know, with defense and good bullpen and close game management, they're kind of built for that kind of a grind, which, you know, the first week of the season is never a good judge of that because there's so many off days. Now, once you get into the stretch where I think they have like 57 games in 63 days starting on Friday, you know, that's where you see some of that separation for baseball teams and how you manage your bench, your pitching staff, your bullpen and everything. So, you know, I guess that roundabout way that works out to a guy like Soria is going to have a bad outing every now and then. Wade Davis gave up some runs against the Angels in that one game last year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it happens. Nobody hits 1,000 and nobody throws a no-hitter every time out. Even Noah Syndergaard gave up, 19 homers last year. So it's not like he's perfect either. It's just one of those things that, you know, sometimes you're going to have a bad day and you just hope that your good days outweigh the bad ones and you know, work up to a solid season. And I think Soria's going to do that.
Yes, I would agree. And so with that, I think we will take our break for the moment, and then we'll come back and we'll finish up with some kind of clean up with some of the other interesting thoughts we had from the first couple games, and then look forward to this weekend as the Royals continue the 2016 season. So stick with us at the break, and we'll have more Royals talk on the other side.
The Kansas City Baseball Vault will be right back after these messages.
Nice running catch by the right fielder. There's a first major league hit by Alex Gordon. Kind of fist through the left side of the infield.
The Vault.
Kansas City is excited for a world championship defense in 2016. After setting team attendance records last year, the Royals have become the hottest ticket in town. There's nothing like watching a game at Kauffman Stadium, but if you're looking for an alternative or you can't find a ticket, you should try Kelly's Westport Inn. Kelly's Westport Inn has TVs all over, spacious lower floor, and more upstairs on Randall's rooftop. You'll always find a friendly bar staff that are ready to talk Royals baseball with you, and they have drink specials every day. It's a great place to watch a road game, and if you were there for any of the playoff games last season, you know how fun and wild it can be to cheer on the boys in blue surrounded by other Royals fans. And how about this? You don't have to pay $12 for parking. Kelly's is located in the heart of Westport, where they've served the best drinks since 1947. Let their tradition become part of your tradition.
And welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, Baseball Prospectus, Kansas City affiliate. So the first half of the show, we talked about, well, I don't know if it'll actually be half, it might be first portion of the show, I should say. We talked about the most interesting aspect, which there's not a whole lot interesting about two games, because you have to kind of see things develop over a longer period before it can be truly interesting. But the Soria thing was the most. But some other, we'll have kind of a just a little, some quick hits of things that we noticed. And Eric Hosmer off to a pretty good start for the season. First game, he was 3-for-4 with an RBI, and he had some clutch hits. Looked like, you know, Hosmer more and more, kind of just from the eye test, looks like he's assuming that role of just budding superstar type player. He still needs to get the results to make that leap. You know, I mean, there was, just to have an example, that I'm not comparing Eric Hosmer to Bryce Harper, because Bryce Harper's just, he's different stratosphere than literally
can't anyone, compare
Trout. But, you know, before last year, people were kind of like, well, Harper's really good, but he hasn't quite lived up to that hype. You know, it was supposed to be just this unbelievable dominant player, and he'd had some good seasons, and he didn't blow you away like everyone was expecting him to. And then last season, boom, there it was. And he is that, and he's still, what, he's like 17 years old still.
I mean, pretty much,
so
yeah.
Young. And that was kind of why he was still kind of figuring things out, but now he's in his prime and he's probably going to hit 60 home runs for the next 10 years. But anyway, you know, that was that leap, that step that Bryce Harper took. He always looked the part. Hosmer hasn't always looked the part necessarily when you see him, but you know, hopefully his stats can back up that he's starting to look more the part, at least to my eyes. Now, one thing that I hadn't really noticed before, Jess Mendoza did a really good job of pointing out on the broadcast, if you were watching, she talked about how Eric Hosmer has a kind of ground ball swing. He doesn't necessarily use it every time, because she did note that he can elevate the ball quite a bit and makes good contact when he elevates it, but that a lot of times he has swings that almost look like he's going for a grounder. And I thought that was really interesting, because he had every hit that he's had this year has been on the ground. And it kind of harkens back to in 2011, if you remember, before he got called up to the majors, and he was hitting 439 in Omaha, and he had all these hits, but all but three of them were singles, and so many of them were on, you know, were grounders, and he wasn't hitting a ton of fly balls. And that was kind of a, well, you know, maybe there's a possible issue there. And I'm not going to say it's an issue. Again, small sample size, so it's nearly impossible to tell. But it was something that, you know, he's historically, he's hit, you know, a lot more grounders than you think someone of his power capabilities would hit. So I did think that was kind of intriguing and something to kind of watch for as we move forward. I mean, what do you think when you hear that?
Well, I think that's always been kind of a thing. He seems like he's always been around 50% of the balls that he puts in play going on the ground. And when we were doing our over-unders, that was one of the factors that, you know, kind of saps what power he might have. Because you watch him, when he hits a home run, he does not get cheated. He drills the ball. He's got power to all fields.
He can
crush it out of Kauffman to left. I mean, he's got power. It very clearly is there. It's just that I don't know if it's approach so much or mechanics. I'm gonna have to go back and find that Mendoza segment, because I haven't seen that broadcast yet. I mean, it's definitely something that I think is apparent. It's something that we've seen throughout the years, and it's in some ways maybe it's maturity early in his career where he's trying to pull things and starts grounding it to second. You know, he did that a lot. Alex Gordon did that a lot in his first few years, but I think there is probably something there that, you know, maybe it is just a mechanical thing. And this early in the year, maybe it's just maybe it's timing. You know, that could be part of it. But everything that he's put in play has been on the ground. You know, he had a couple ground outs. You know, he had three base hits on opening night, all of them on the ground. One of them was a bunt. So, I mean, what you going to do there? But, you know, that is a situation where if he's not elevating the ball, it doesn't take advantage of what strength he has in that regard. So that's a pretty important you know, element is, you know, if you're going to be a first baseman and you're 6'4", 225 like Hosmer, that looks like a guy who can hit 30, 40 homers, and he's yet to hit 20. So I think there is something, I think it's a combination of a lot of those things that, you know, one, probably approach. He's smart enough to know that you can't always hit it out of Kauffman. It's, you know, such a big stadium, as we've talked about, and as most people know.
Well documented.
Well documented. And so, you know, maybe he said earlier in an article that he was going to try to go more gap to gap at the K, just because it's a big outfield and that plays more to the field and everything. And, you know, like, I guess that makes some sense. But I do think that there is some level of just a different approach and the mechanics and everything that go into play there. So, you know, to see him get all those hits on grounders, it's good that they're hits, but at the same time, you know, those are ground balls, and ground balls generally, you know, they don't generally sneak through for hits. That's kind of what you're counting on. Getting the ball in play, that's good, and that's the Royals' thing, but, you know, you do want to see more driving of the ball, and you know, you're not necessarily doing that when you're hitting the ball on the ground half the time. So that's something that I think maybe this is the year it turns around, and he kind of got him out of his system now. But, you know, I do think it's definitely a pattern. I think it's part of his profile at this stage. And until he changes that, until it's an adjustment that he makes or what have you, I mean, I think it's part of who he is, and it's fair to kind of tag him as a ground ball hitter.
Yeah. So, you know, not necessarily a huge, you know, oh, Hosmer's going to have a bad season, because I definitely don't think that, but something to watch. Another thing to watch is a guy that we've talked an awful lot about, Danny Duffy. So he's starting off the season in the bullpen. You know, I mean, if there was, you feel like that's kind of what he's going to be this year, because if there was a chance, if the Royals still wanted him to be a starter, you know, Ian Kennedy having to skip a start seemed like it'd be a prime opportunity, but they put Chris Young in there, and maybe it's something where they still see Duffy as a starter and they want him to get some confidence built up in the bullpen. And maybe we'll see him as a starter down the road. Who knows? But it was kind of interesting. He had even in the microcosm of less than two innings, Danny Duffy had a quintessential Danny Duffy start.
Pretty so much, yeah.
He pitched 1 2/3 innings, comes out the first inning. This is game two. Game two makes it sound like the playoffs, the second game of the season.
Right.
he came out and first inning, lights out, pitched really well, looked really sharp. They brought him back out. This was the sixth inning after Chris Young pitched a real solid five innings. Again, a very Chris Young five innings. Yep. And then Duffy comes back out for the seventh inning, and he looks like the struggle bus Duffy, who, you know, trying to paint the corners, getting caught up being too precise, walking guys, allowing hits, just overall not looking very sharp. So you had the best and the worst of Danny Duffy all within the span of 1 2/3 innings. Didn't finish that that second inning, and Luke Cochaver was brought in again to save the day, which he did. It's become very, very much his role, which I'm okay with, absolutely. So it's really, I don't know what to think about Danny Duffy anymore. I mean, the dude has so much talent. He's a lefty who can consistently throw in the high 90s. You know, like, those power lefties are so hard to find, but he just can't seem to put it all together. And I look at things and I read things, and you try and piece it together what the issue is, and I can't figure it out. I mean, what at this point, what are your thoughts on Danny Duffy? I mean, it's so perplexing.
It is. He's just a weird enigma as a pitcher. I was listening to Jeff Passan on The Drive on my way home today, which actually, ironically, is kind of rare. I don't listen to sports talk radio that often. But they were talking about Duffy, and Passman was like, yeah, I kind of, you know, just couldn't make up his mind either as far as what Duffy is. General thought was that, hey, maybe another organization, once he hits free agency, they'll see him still as a starter, but he can still make his money as a reliever. You know, you look at, you know, Soria got 3 years, $25 million. You look at other guys, and Duffy's a lefty, so there's some specialization there. And he's particularly effective against lefties. So, you know, he's a guy who could throw one or two innings at a time, could spot start for you. You know, I mean, there's, from his point of view, if he's comfortable as a reliever, he doesn't have the financial kind of pressure to need to start, because the value's not necessarily entirely wrapped up in starting pitching. At least like the mid-tier kind of stuff that he would be probably commanding on the market. You know, he'd be more of like the, I don't know. I don't even know what his market would be as a starter, because, hey, I don't know if he's a starter. I think it's generally more that he's going to be playing that kind of role where he'll spot start. Maybe someone gets hurt and they stretch him out and he still makes 10 to 15 starts this year. But if he's lights out in the bullpen, there's not much incentive for the Royals to change that up, especially when they have guys who they could possibly call up to fill in as starters. When they have, you know, Dylan G hanging out in the bullpen, and they have, well, I guess Chris Medlin's a bad example just because he's gonna be in the rotation. I mean, they don't have to move Duffy if they, you know, unless they're really compelled to do so. So if they're comfortable with him as a reliever, he'll probably stay a reliever. You know, I think he can still start, but I, you know, maybe Kansas City's not the place where it's going to happen, and maybe he's not even looking for that. Maybe he's comfortable. I know we've said it here and we've heard it multiple times that he feels comfortable as a reliever, and maybe there's something to that, that kind of feeling that you don't know if you're going to be in on that particular day. If you're a starter, you know, every fifth day, hey, there it is. And maybe you get a little too amped up for it. If you're in the bullpen, you got to be ready, but you know, there is probably some adjustment to not being so amped up like you might be on a start day, but still amped up enough that you can go out there and gun it for 98 miles an hour. Just knowing that, hey, you come to the ballpark, I might be pitching today. You know, it's enough adrenaline, but it's not so much that you're worked up for most of the week to get to it. And I don't know, maybe that's part of the issue with Duffy. I'm not sure.
I mean, it was something that, you know, when Zach Greinke was here trying to work his way back, there was something that he really responded to, and that was that bullpen role. And then that fed into him, you know, because that's at the kind of end of 07 and 08 seasons, as Greinke was coming back, that was the role he filled until he finally got back to being comfortable enough to be in that starter role. And then 2009, obviously the fantastic season where he won the Cy Young. So, you know, I'm sure in the back of their mind, the Royals are hoping for some sort of transformation like that. And, you know, that would be fantastic, obviously, but it's just, he's so hard to read. And so it's just tough to tell whether it's looking at the numbers, looking at the eye test, everything. It's just, it's so hard to get a bead on what Danny Duffy is and what he's going to be. So another thing to keep a watch on as the season evolves. So I think the final point we can kind of talk about is, we've mentioned him a few times. I want to talk about Luke Hochaber. And, you know, 2013 was when he made the transition to being a reliever. 2014, he had the Tommy John. So he had to sit on the sidelines with the World Series run in that year. And then last year was a huge part of the World Series run. And, you know, last year, he was kind of still moving back or coming back from Tommy John. Nobody quite knew what his role was. They just knew that he could pitch, and they were going to put him in where they could. And now, since they know where he's at, they could have a defined role for him, but it doesn't really seem like he has one, unless that defined role is what he's done the first two games of the season, which is the quote-unquote fireman role, where he can, you know, even if you already brought a reliever in, and that person's having trouble, then he can come in and he can clean up for you. Because someone like a Wade Davis, you know, he does really well, and Greg Holland, I think, was very similar, they do really well with a clean sheet, if you will. You know, having just coming on with a clean inning, nobody on base. They could set up their game. They could pitch their way, and I think that was beneficial to them. But Hoshever has really shown a very good ability to come in high leverage, high stress situations with with players on base and get out of jams, which is an incredible asset to have, and also very perplexing for him, given Hoshever was always, as a starter, was always so much better with nobody on base. And then right. with people on base was when he really had the issues. So kind of a little bit of a role reversal for him as a reliever, but one that I'm certainly welcoming, as he, that seems like a really good role for him. And, you know, if you want to have your main three be Soria, Herrera, Davis, and then if one of those guys gets in trouble, bring in Hoshever to clean it up, or if you need to go another additional inning or something, you've got Hoch. I mean, that's a really valuable piece to have, that guy basically at your beck and call whenever you truly need someone.
I thought that was interesting that, you know, if you'd have told me in 2012 that, hey, a few years from now, the Royals are going to get World Series rings, and in that series, Luke Hoshever is going to relieve both Joaquin Soria and Danny Duffy and get out of jams for them, I'd have called you crazy. Because I don't know.
Just slapped you upside the head.
It's like, what are you talking about? Because I guess if nothing else, Luke Hoshever is used to pitching with runners on from his days as a starter.
Hey-o.
So I mean, but it was interesting that he was the guy that they brought in those spots. It's just, you know, I mean, ideally a manager would evolve to be where, you know, hey, we're gonna bring in our best pitcher at the toughest time, at the most important time, and in, you know, a perfect world that would be Wade Davis, just because, hey, get out of the jam now and, you know, you're probably going to be good. But, you know, Hoshever is a guy, you saw him, you know, towards the end of last season and through the playoffs and in 2013, that he can pitch effectively. It's just that when you're in a bullpen that already has Wade Davis and Kelvin Herrera and Greg Holland pre-injury, it's pretty easy to be overlooked. And so he's always been, at least since he converted to reliever, someone who's been able to kind of air it out. So I'm a little bit surprised that he has at least filled this role for two games, but, you know, maybe that's a way, if you have your standard three headed monster of Soria, Herrera, Davis, or whatever order you want to use them in, you know, you still have a guy like Hoshever who can come in some of those tight situations, maybe with runners on and coming, getting out and get you out of that jam. So I think it's really interesting. I'm not sure how much they're going to continue to use it. And I think a lot of it probably hinges on how other guys pitch. So if Soria continues to have some struggles, then you probably see them flip flop where Hoshever is going to have more of that, you know, that setup role more consistently. But, you know, if he can come out and do that and be the guy, you know, the sixth inning is always kind of the tough spot for a lot of teams, because that's where your pitcher, your starter is usually hitting the opposing lineup for the third time. There's fatigue. There's just general, you know, it's almost too early to start your setup game to get to your closer. You know, it's such an awkward inning to manage. If you have a guy like Hoshever who can come in and get you two outs if somebody gets on, well, that's a pretty good weapon to have. And that it's Hoshever is still crazy. It's still so weird to have it be Hoshever when with so much of his history with the Royals being either just subpar or, you know, just rotten until he hit the bullpen.
He and Gordon are those two guys that just, as Royals players, they embody not only what it's been like to be a Royal this past decade, but to be a Royals fan as well. You know, both of them really high draft picks, really high expectations, failed to meet them initially, battled back through adversity, finally pieced it all together, and were two huge pieces of the Royals winning a World Series, and figure to be two huge pieces of this season going forward. So I like to say it gives me the warm fuzzies when I think about them just because of that fact. You know, we've been Royals fans for so long, and so many players with high expectations have come and gone, and we finally you know, those two guys, you were able to see them actually get to the promised land. Like, that's just really cool, you know. So there's that. And I guess
a number one overall and a number two overall pick.
Yep. And I said that'd be our last point, but I guess one last tiny quick hit we can have is shouldn't go without notice. Edinson Volquez and his pitch, his performance on opening night, which I thought was fantastic. He picked up right where he left off in the postseason, looked really good. And if that is the Edinson Volquez that the Royals get all season, then that's exactly what you want from him. So, I mean, did you have much thoughts on his performance?
I thought it was interesting that the velocity was still there. You know, we saw that spike in the playoffs and he's still throwing 96, 97. I was like, okay. There is Craig Brown posted something earlier. I think it was yesterday, maybe. But it's on BP Kansas City anyway. It's not like the posts disappear or anything. Mm-hmm. So you'll be able to find it. He kind of looked at it inning by inning, and the velocity did kind of drop as it went along, which is expected. And so maybe we'll see in the next start that it comes back down to what a more typical level is. But, you know, I mean, for somebody who was kind of, you know, dismissed when he signed, you know, he's been way better than advertised and seems to be really, really comfortable as a Royal and with this defense and with Dave Island and all of that. So, he's fit in really nicely, and I thought it was really cool that when they were handing out rings, he got an Eddie chant from the crowd, which is just cool, which harkens back to when he got in that jam in against Toronto in game one of the ALCS and got through it. You know, oh, man, just spontaneously, so everybody just starts chanting Eddie, and he gets through it, and God, wouldn't you know it, like, you know, then you get into the drama of the World Series where his father passes away, and then he wins game one, learns of it, comes back, wins, you know, pitches a good game in game five. I mean, that's just cool. That's one of those things where the guy just, you know, you're going to remember Edinson Volquez for a while as a Royals fan. So hopefully he keeps it going.
Yeah, it's crazy to think last year was Volquez's first year as a Royal. Him and Morales both, you know, it feels like they've been with the Royals so much longer. They fit right in, and they're so much fun to watch, so great to see play. And, you know, Volquez especially, because he's, for the pitching staff, he's somewhat of a vocal leader, I think, on the team. So it's really good. It's hard to think, you know, we talk about this 2017 window, and he and Morales are not signed through 2017. So I got to think the Royals will make some effort to bring them back, but you know, Volquez hoping
has an option, but I don't know what the terms of it are.
Okay.
They both might, but I don't know off the top of my head.
Royals love options, so it's no.
They sure do. No,
as they should.
They might be mutual, though. So if they're mutual options, then those are tough to match up.
Yeah. But I mean, if the Royals, if they make the playoffs again, make another, and God willing, another World Series run, I mean, it'd be hard for, if you were those two players, I don't know why you would want to. I guess I kind of go back and forth on that. After you won a World Series, and then, you know,
let's maybe that's your time to move on. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, because it's like I can cash in now. I don't have to worry about, oh, I never got a ring.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, then it's like, oh, man.
Why leave when you just won the World Series?
Why would I leave? So, yeah, I see it both ways. But that's down the road. So I think with that, we'll wrap it up for this evening, or whenever, morning, afternoon, whenever you're listening.
Whatever time of day.
Yeah.
Great thing about podcasts. My mom, I guess she didn't know that I had a podcast. I don't know how she didn't, or didn't know that I was still doing it. And she was like, you're on the radio. I'm like, well, it's a podcast. And she's like, what time is it on? And I'm like, it's whenever.
Right now.
So mom, if you're listening, hi.
Oh, hi mom. Hi.
Yeah.
Ingles mom. And my mom, she's listening. Hi mom. But
hi Jess mom.
So with that, I think we'll leave you, and we're finally here, folks. It's been a long off season, but a sweet one as the Royals World Series champions, and their title defense has begun. And this weekend they're facing the Minnesota Twins. So it'll be be back to the grind now once we get these off days over with, and we'll have a lot more baseball to talk about moving forward. So stick with us all season. The title defense has begun. It's going to be a fantastic season, and the Kansas City Baseball Vault is here for you, listeners. So keep listening. For Michael Engel, I am Jeff Herr. Thanks for tuning in, and as always, go Royals.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at bprokansascity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to KansasCityBaseballVault@gmail.com.